Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Hi, welcome back. Our audience today is going to get a great opportunity to spend a little bit more time with my favorite counselor, Ken Clark, out of Arkansas. And we're about ready to head into the holidays. Yeah, he's a hog guy, which is fantastic. So as we're getting ready to head into the holidays, these holidays are steeped with anxiety, wondering how to navigate if you have somebody in your family that's dealing with substance abuse disorder. And where are the boundaries? Where aren't the boundaries? How do I do this? Do I have them? Do I not have them? How do I love them through? All the things. And so we're going to touch on that throughout the hour that we have together today. And Ken, before we got on today, I asked him, does he have his own story? Because I didn't know. And so we're going to start with that today, because I think that it helps our audience have a window into his own personal journey and some of the decisions that he's made and experiences that he's had. And then we'll move into, certainly out of his own experience, not just as a counselor, but also as a human being, what to say and what to stop saying during the holiday season. So Ken, welcome again.
This is a great podcast. And for those of you that are listening at home, I'm just thankful that this and things like this are out there. Like, this is a big part of what we need to start doing, meaningful conversations that aren't necessarily moments of decision, but just moments of learning and educating and exploring and wandering through these topics. They're tough topics.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we do need more of these conversations because there's so much shame and judgment surrounding all of this that people tend to silo up, and that is dangerous. So if you would kind of start with your story that we had started talking about a little bit before we got on, I would love to hear. And so would our audience.
So I grew up in a family where I was a half Southern Baptist, half Catholic. Both of those are probably adamantly against drinking and do a lot of closet drinking as the as populations. But so was raised in this really odd environment where I obviously warned about the spiritual consequences or whatever of drinking, right? By the Southern Baptist side, they're a bunch of teetotalers surface. And then also warned from the Catholic side about this Scotch-Irish, man. We do drinking as a national sport, right? So definitely some warnings there that were handed down to me by the men in our families of your great grandfather did this, all that kind of stuff. Depression era, World War II. I mean, I'm not saying it's okay, but there was a lot of stimuli that drinking was friendly to. And it was that madman culture, right? That 1950s, 1960s culture, two martini lunches, all that. And that was part of being a business guy. And I'm a business guy. So I was warned about all that. And I grew up not seeing either of my parents really drink. Remember my dad's boss bringing him home once intoxicated when I was 5 or 6. It choked me up. It was one of my father's most shameful moments. Now in hindsight, I've been intoxicated enough over my journey that probably wasn't earth shattering as it felt at 5, but my father was so ashamed. And so I grew up with these strong warnings about it. And at the same time, my parents threw some great social events. And so people would bring over alcohol as gifts, right? Like you bring a housewarming gift or whatever. We had this incredible stocked bar that my parents never imbibed from that I was aware of. But from an early age, I was fascinated with all the different bottles and shapes and colors. And by the time I was in middle school and high school, I figured out, by the way, I wasn't as popular as I thought. We just had the well-stocked bar that all my friends would sneak stuff out of when I was. So didn't intoxicate until I went off to college for the first time. And then it was ironically, right? There's a moment where that first time kind of shook me to the core. And I don't mean to put any bravado around. This speaks to that alcoholic gene or however we narrow it down. It was a fraternity thing and it was pledging and they made us all drink. And all these guys who'd spent their whole high school drinking and stuff, I'm the last person standing. And I drank just as much. And I remember thinking, I think my dad might have been right. Ooh. Like, I've never had a sip and I drank these guys under the table. That could be a sign, right? So I had probably a bad year in college, got married, became a professional guy, had kids, and was pretty good about that stuff. And then two moments in particular, one, losing my dad about a decade ago, definitely spent a year over medicating with alcohol on that. And then as a business owner, we've built this huge business. And there's points where you end up on the floor in fetal position because you're scared out of your mind. And yeah. Alcohol fits into that pretty dang easy. So definitely had my moments. What I was saying before we jumped on this call is I think I'm at a very contemplative place about what is the value of this, right? And it's got huge social underpinnings in the South, but like, why do I even care for this? What is the point? I took a year off drinking a couple of years ago. It was one of the best years of my life. I actually had a mental conversation with myself. If this is the difference between making $1 million a year as a business owner and not, would I give up drinking forever? And the answer was, hell yes, in a heartbeat. As hard as I worked to build this, if you told me the one tipping point thing missing was me putting down the glass, I'm in. Talking before, very frankly, I'm again at a position where I'm probably ready to not drink, even though I don't perceive myself as having a substance use disorder. I don't know where it goes from here. I don't see what the value is. I see what it adds to my life besides having to tolerate an occasional ribbing from somebody who drinks too much that I'm not having to drink, right? And we were mentioning before, one of the big things that influenced me on this, and then I'll shut up and let you talk too, but there's a program out there called Seven Challenges, which is a teen program. It's a really fascinating approach, kind of not the AA approach. And I love AA and really believe in that. Seven questions, these very simple questions about, we've committed to taking a meaningful look of the place of substances in our life. We're committed to taking a meaningful look on whether or not these things add value or take away value. They're all these very open-ended questions that theoretically somebody could say, yeah, I'm actually a better person with it. And the discussion would be over. But I found those seven challenge questions have haunted me since I first saw them 8 or 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Of like, wow, like, what is the value to this, right? So that's where we are. Yeah. And we love social culture, celebration culture, all that kind of stuff. And yet I don't see it as anything besides drag in my world. And in my late 40s, early 50s, kids off at college, it'd be easy for that to become part of my personality. That's my journey with it. And I think my wife is at the same spot. We have very open conversations about it. We have open conversations with our kids about it. I'm very thankful for our dialogue with our kids where they talk about the same thing. Like, is this really providing value for them?
Yeah. So two questions that I'm really curious about. One is, I have a number of clients that I work with that are around your age and that are having the same conversations with themselves. So I think it is just up for people to reflect and think and be much more choiceful about this, the impact that it's having. And exactly what you said is what most of my clients are saying is, why am I doing, like, what is the benefit of doing this? And they're kind of coming to the conclusion and asking the question, I don't think there's a benefit of doing this because I, all the things. So the other question I have that I'm super curious about is, what was the thing that after your dad passed, and you went into that year of medicating the feelings, what was the thing that pulled you out?
What was the thing that pulled me out? The pulling in, which probably ties to the pulling out, is there was a place that I could get to emotionally that I wasn't trained to get to because I wasn't raised with good emotional intelligence, wasn't raised to feel and break down and have a cathartic cry. I could get there with alcohol and grieve my dad in a way that was dysfunctional, but also felt productive. Whereas at that cerebral level, there's a line in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof that really struck me. It was probably in the middle of that. That was one of those turning points, is one of the characters in there who has an alcohol problem talks about he drinks until he hears the click. Right. And like this moment where his brain converts over to a different way of thinking. And I think there's probably that realization that I am literally using this for something that I should have learned how to do emotionally. Grieve.
Right. Right.
And my sons were preteen right at that point. And there was that moment of like, they're officially really watching with different eyes, right? Being in school, hearing about substance use and watching me pour a strong bourbon at the end of a day. Like, what's my legacy they take from this? What shit do I stop from rolling downhill?
Right.
It ends with me. And so that was one. That's even where we began. I mean, I took a year off. I told them I'm taking a year off. I don't think this has been good for me lately. They see that transparency there, which invites that transparency from them.
Right, right, right. And what did you learn in that year off about your...
Oh, good LaCroix was? Good Lord. That's one of the first things that occurred to me was part of me that, trigger warning here, right? The part of me that missed that crisp, cold, like I could get that same experience from other things, but I had falsely conflated certain moments to alcohol alone. Like that moment of release or that moment of physical distraction is limited to alcohol. And I started learning that there was a lot of other things that provided the same sensations, the same release, the same ritual, whatever, that didn't have to involve alcohol. And I think alcohol had become too idealized in my world, in our culture, right? Perfect end to a good day is, I think of Josh, nothing makes a man feel more like a man than drinking beer on his roof after he's tarted. Like, we have these enculturated things around cigarettes and alcohol that we deserve. And that's a reward and party, all kinds of stuff you can do. My physical activity started going through the roof. I've always been a guy who has carried a few too many pounds. And I found that there was a virtuous cycle instead of a downward spiral between drinking and exercise. The more I exercised, the less I wanted to drink. The more I didn't drink, the more I wanted to exercise. And something that had been a point of self-loathing or shame or not liking myself for 40 years.
Wow.
So that was probably the big lesson is, God, I made this more important than it is. Like, it's really not the skeleton key to all locks like I thought it was.
Yeah. And you had your business at that point, your counseling company.
Yeah.
And so how did that change how you showed up at work and the work that you've done?
I'll tell you, probably the biggest thing is I just started talking about it out loud. There's something weird that came on the other side of not drinking. Like, it was really freeing to tell people, like, hey, I've taken like 6 months off. Telling other business owners, coaching calls with groups of practice owners, I now regularly talk about drinking too much as a coping mechanism. And I get email after email like, oh my gosh, that was so great to hear. Me too. Maybe this is my sign that I need to dial back a little bit. So I think what showed up was a more authentic self, where this part of my life, none of us want to admit that we might be overdoing it a little or a lot of a problem. So I started saying, like, this is normal. This is like a lot of business owners fight this crap. And it's one of those things that when you say out loud, like, yeah, I think it might be time for me to dial back, a lot of other people are like, can you tell me about that? Because I've been thinking, to your point, right? These people that you coach. So I think that was like, I'm a great leader. I'm a good business owner, but I was only 90% authentic because I wasn't admitting out loud that I'm not sure where this fits into my life, but right now I'm going to pretend like it's a non-issue. That made me a more charismatic leader. Started sleeping better too. I'll tell you, now that you're processing out loud, one of the other things that changed was I kind of had this running joke in my head as an entrepreneur that if I can get in bed by 10 o'clock, I'm going to rule the world. Like, because if I'm in bed at 10, I'm up at 5, that gives me 2 hours before my kids get up to get all kinds of stuff done. And then I'm a present parent in the morning. Like, there's all these things that fall in down line from in bed at 10. And alcohol was keeping me from getting in bed by 10. And I would usually get into the peanut butter pretzels and Netflix about 10:30. And then I'd burn another hour or two. Right. And I mean, now you're kind of in this unwind mode. You're having a little bit of a good time and you don't want to go to bed. And so it was really messing up my sleep, and my sleep got substantially better without alcohol in my world.
I think that's one of the things that I routinely hear over and over again is, and fundamentally, sleep is so freaking important for us.
I tell people, like, whatever else you think about it, it's fine. But like, now that we don't waterboard people at Guantanamo Bay, the number one way that we break people is sleep deprivation.
Yes.
That's how we get people to like lose their minds and we think they know or whatever. We do that to ourselves recreationally. Wow.
Isn't that stunning?
It's mind blowing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's do a little shift here. And thank you so much for sharing that. We had talked earlier about a discussion around, certainly during the holidays, heightened and regularly, just as walking around human beings. When we have somebody that we love who is dealing with substance abuse disorder, what I want you to speak to is, what are the 5 things that we can say and we should say, and that should be part of our language with our loved ones? And what are the things we need to stop saying and dump and minimize saying?
So we're going to go slightly controversial or provocative here today. I hope it brings
up. I love it. I love provocative.
When we were talking about this before, right? I think of like these stop eating this and start eating this, right? I see these great things in magazines or whatever. Don't eat the chips, eat the carrots or whatever. So this is kind of that. So I think the one at the top of my list, which is going to feel provocative to a lot of people, is I want you to stop saying I love you. And I want you to start saying I like you. You've heard me speak before. One of my big things is to be loved without being liked means you're being tolerated. Yeah. If you're lucky, I love you, because otherwise you're abhorrent or your behavior is disgusting. In other words, I don't enjoy you. It's only love that allows me to tolerate being around you. That's a shame-inducing realization for somebody that we're being put up with. And shame is something that really fits well into substance use and numbing and all that. Likewise, when we know we're enjoyed, when we know we're liked, which is different than knowing that we're loved, something there that we don't want to lose. right? I'm on camera here. That's why we do this sometimes, right? Before we like crowded room after a long day, like I want to make sure I don't smell, right? Like,
right.
So by shifting on to what is admirable with somebody, even though mm-hmm. we're frustrated with them, that we still do enjoy in the midst of it, that creates a point of reconnection. It creates something that destroys shame and says, you don't need to run away and hide, even if it's mm-hmm. in the guest room with a bottle of something. That's probably the first big one, is to move away from that. So
yeah, that's got power. Definitely has power and maybe provocative for some people. But I had another conversation with a really great friend of mine yesterday. And one of the things that he talked about was our ability to see that best version of the person that we love and to hold that up as a regular thing that we still see despite the substance abuse disorder, because that part is all still there. Yeah. And if we can speak to that from a, I not only love you, I really like you perspective, very powerful, Ken.
Yeah. So the second thing I would focus on is that we would stop talking about the past and the future and try and talk about the present moment as much mm-hmm. as possible. I think when there's somebody with substance use issues, right, it's really easy to talk about the old wounds or our contributions to it. If I was just mm-hmm. a better dad, a better mom, better sibling, we wouldn't be in the situation. Or I'm just so afraid that you're never going to get a handle on this and you're going to piss away a great career or whatever, right? It's like I tell couples, I'm a couples therapist by training, right? Like talking about the past is just your version versus somebody else's version of events. It's a chemical imprint on the brain. You're probably both wrong, by the way. Talking about the future is just your guess versus somebody else's guess, that your marriage actually only exists one place. It's in the present moment on my couch right now. So all these discussions, they have a saying in the South, right? Don't borrow trouble. And in other words, like, don't get upset about the future that's not even here yet. Again, when we look at things that ramp us up and make us mm-hmm. not great caregivers, friends, family, and also push people down that kind of ladder of functioning, the past and the future go there really easy. And yet mm-hmm. they're so impractical. Like we just accomplished a whole lot. That doesn't mean that we don't get good therapy or don't do moments of healing or don't do whatever. Mm-hmm. Talk about the future. Mm-hmm. It needs to make sure that we don't go from seeing somebody sneak into the kitchen in an otherwise good moment to pour themselves mm-hmm. an extra drink they shouldn't be having, to now talking about the past instead of watching Christmas Story and just focusing on that connection. I don't fully believe this, but it's still a beautiful saying to wrestle with. My wife is who I heard it from. She's a great trauma therapist. My wife says that the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And in those moments where we break connection, mm-hmm. we actually raise the incentive for all parties to embrace bad coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. Focus on the present. Be present. Mm-hmm. Focus on the sights, sounds, smells, whatever, of being with your kid, being with your spouse. I'm a high anxiety guy. My wife walks me through a 4-3-2-1, which is, this is how she gets me grounded in the present moment when I'm kind of off deep end. What's four mm-hmm. things you can see right now? Three things you can touch right now, two mm-hmm. things you can hear, and one thing you can smell. Like checking into the present moment. If thinking about your past with your kid, look at them and just try and enjoy the fact that you like their new haircut or that gray in their beard looks really mm-hmm. good, or be present and so good. And so that's mm-hmm. number two.
Awesome.
Focus on the past and the future.
I love that.
Yeah. So the third is to focus on, I didn't have a better term for this, but it comes from my old time in the insurance world. Focus on comparative responsibility, not the binaries, right? Is this my fault or your fault? The reality is, right, we're going to get into some of these discussions inevitably. I go there. Need to focus on the fact that addiction is really multi-causal, right? Mm-hmm. That addiction and substance use disorders are often a somewhat perfect storm that comes together. Would my kid not be an addict if I was a better parent? No, that's not how it works. Would that combined with four or five other factors going in their direction, mm-hmm. them not being an addict? Yes, that's more mm-hmm. accurate. So this comparative negligence or this comparative responsibility thing of realizing your spouse had a choice, still has a choice, right? Mm-hmm. Still has some agency. You have a choice to get help and acknowledge that they don't have much choice in it anymore. Whatever it is, they have some responsibility. You have some responsibility. It's super complex. So stop doing what Freud did, because we threw the guy out years ago, and trying to pin it down to one source of cause, one bad moment. Your mom didn't hug you enough. That's why you're an alcoholic. Like, stop that stuff. That the storm that you're in has five or six contributing factors at least, which means take care of your piece and recognize what you can't control. Because when we over reduce it to this is my fault or this is your fault, we don't have anything actionable that we can do besides accept or reject that blame. And that's super unproductive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think just the conversation around blame alone could take 45 minutes.
45 years.
Yeah. So, okay. Third, brilliant too.
So fourth is going to be, and I'm going to hedge this by saying where appropriate. You need to be aware of people's boundaries. We need to be cognizant of consent, all that kind of stuff. But I'm going to encourage people to replace talking with touching. Now that's gonna make me cry. Hold on to it a little longer before you let go, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe take a chance and put your arm around somebody that you haven't been able to in a year or two. So this goes back to connection, right? There's something that is safe touch, not something about it. We know what it does in the brain. It releases oxytocin in the brain. Mm-hmm. When we get continuous touch, usually like 30 seconds or longer, I always think of Good Will Hunting where Robin Williams is saying to Matt Damon, "It's not your fault." And he's like, "I know." And he keeps saying it and he finally starts hugging him. Makes he cry. And Matt Damon kind of like hitting at him, and about 30 seconds in, he just collapses into surrender. That's where that brain clicked over and said, "This is not a threat. You're safe." You can't get that a lot of times without touch. If there's ever going to be a moment where you push through your cultural standards, or we weren't huggers in our family or whatever, and try and show somebody that they are worth drawing close to, that they're the opposite of disgusting, because we don't touch disgusting things as humans. I don't touch piles of poop, right? We touch what is beautiful and worthy. And there's something about that needs to happen more. And you don't need to be good at it. You can literally walk by your kid and say, "I know it's super weird. I need a hug. Come here and give me a hug." The dork about it. Talk about how awkward you feel and do it anyway, because there's something about that clears up worth and value.
Yeah.
That all these saying like, "Oh, we have a lot of good memories as a family," or whatever, like it just can't replace that.
I'm totally with you on that. I did not grow up in a hugging family. And somewhere along the way, I was like, okay, I'm a hugger. And so with almost all my clients, I hug them when I see them and I hug them when they walk out the door. And some of them, that may be the only hug they get that. And then I've started doing the 30-second hugs, but the heart hugs where you shift to the other side and it's heart to heart. And that is, again, extraordinarily powerful for people who just don't get that kind of connection with people. And they all know I'm super safe. So that's the one place they know, whether it's the only place that they get that's going to happen for
them. It's one of the oldest anecdotes in human experience, right? And you see it play out so many different ways. Everything from the real famous studies in Russian orphanages about the mortality rates in babies were picked up once a day versus not. In the Christian narrative, regardless of what you believe, right? Like one of the whole things was like, touch lepers first, heal them second. Like it wasn't like, use my magic powers to make you not worth touching, right? Mm-hmm. That touch is such a repeated theme.
Yeah.
It's the beautiful moment in a lot of movies and things like that is where he finally reaches their hand over and grabs another human's hand. Like it's amazing. Side note, if you haven't seen it, I'm crying about it still. It's on the internet right now. It's the mom chimp. Mahali is her name. M-A-H-A.
Oh, okay.
And her baby chimp away from her at birth because it wasn't getting enough oxygen and put it back in the, you need to go watch this as soon as we're done.
It's okay.
Like they put the baby chimp back in the cage in a blanket. Put the mom in the enclosure with the baby. And you see the little baby's hand come out of the blanket and the mom realizes it and scoops this baby up. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
We need those moments. We need to be scooped up. We need somebody to hug us a little too long and not let go. And in this environment where addiction tells us we're so unworthy and we're worthy of disgust and things like that, touch clears that up in a way that other things can't. Again, let me hedge it by saying that may be normal for some of us. That may be healing for some of us. It's also going to be other people's trauma. So be attentive to what touch means for people.
Yeah.
In the end, give them a chance to consent in or out, but do more hugging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love it.
Last but not least is stop talking about forgiveness. It's, I think, an oversimplified, overrated concept that I would argue that we have turned forgiveness into forgetting, and that's not how healing works.
Right.
And if the goal is to somehow forget all these things that have happened to us, we're talking to people about needing forgiveness or they need to ask for our forgiveness, like any of that stuff. And we're mixing that with somehow that removes how trauma relives itself in our brain without our choice. That's so unfair. That in fact, what often makes healing so powerful is not that we forget it, but that we remember what we've been through, how bad it was and where we are now.
Right.
That effective requires memory. Forgiveness, I always explain it in terms of student loans, right? Forgiveness means that you no longer have to pay on the debt, right? Student loans forgiven, you no longer ever pay on the debt. To forgive somebody means you are foregoing the right to collect on something they owe you. And if they've hurt you, they owe you whatever, right? That just means you're giving up the right to collect on it. It doesn't mean that debt never existed, that damage wasn't done. And so what we're really doing when we forgive this holiday season or whenever is giving up our right to punish But that's a lot easier to do if we don't have to give up our right to remember what happened to us. In fact, it's where grace and kindness and all things emanate from, is that I'm going to choose to do something different, even though this was a big trauma to me. So that's a big piece of it too, is I want you to stop talking about forgiveness, especially behind the scenes, away from the addict in your life. We don't talk about forgiveness if it equates to forgetting.
Right.
Talk about foregoing punishment. Talk about how revenge doesn't bring anything but more wounding. That's where I would go with that. So those are the big tips. All that to say, by the way, if you're not doing your individual work, wherever it is, whether you have a coach or a therapist, you're in Al-Anon or reading the big book by yourself. And if you're loving somebody with an addiction, you've never read the Al-Anon big book, order it off of Amazon. It's $15. It's worth having on your nightstand and just reading through it. Like, it's spectacular stuff in there as well. If you're not doing your own work, that makes it so much harder. Right? Not doing your own work on this is trying to drive a car with a dirty windshield. Like, it's really tough to see where you're going because it's so gunked up with your own stuff, your own trauma.
Right.
So if you want to help somebody in your life, this, then by helping yourself.
I fully believe, and I know this has been my own journey, is Sam's substance abuse disorder called me to learn more, to take care of myself more, to feel more, to love deeply in ways that I didn't know existed, to change my beliefs from crap, my life's falling apart to, oh, my life is actually falling. And then the vigilant learning that I'm constantly learning. Every conversation I have, every book I read, every movie I watch, every podcast I listen to is continuing to wash in the ocean of my own transformation. And that's what I believe is one of the massive gifts out of this experience, is it gave me a catalytic push to do my own work.
Yep. And that own work individually leads to collective work as cultures, right? I don't know where y'all grew up, but I remember being a kid in Los Angeles in the early 80s, and there was commercials for the Raider Institute, which was a place to go if you had a drinking problem. And it, like, even 30, 40 years, the concept of being an alcoholic, those that were running in those circles understood it was a much bigger problem that applied to a lot of people. But the rest of us still had a mentality that the world can do two martini lunches, and there's a select few that get carried away with it.
Yeah.
We're within the last decade or two still having an evolving conversation as culturally, which starts with individuals, of saying, like, I don't know this stuff makes that much sense, right? That we are still learning as a culture that maybe we shouldn't be drinking or doing these things as much as we do. And we've been medicating ourselves unhealthy. So that, again, comes back to the more that we talk, the more that we listen to these things, the more that we continue the conversation. This is not revealing some great truth that's been there for the last years that all the people that know. We're literally still figuring out as a society. Yeah, we might have a problem. That clarity gets sharper. It comes into focus the more we talk to one another.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing, is when you're not talking, or you're, quote, a private family, and we don't talk about this sort of thing, you are just like clamping down the possibilities of becoming the fullness of being human and understanding that, yes, yes, it's all fascinating to me from that perspective.
Mold grows best in the dark, right?
Yes.
And it's so true with family secrets and things like that.
Yes. And so part of the reason Voices Encouraged was birthed was because, number one, I couldn't find all the resources I needed in one place. And then the other was that I kept running into people that were like, we're not talking about this. Mm-hmm. And certainly it's alive and well in corporate America. We're not talking about this. Too touchy. Can't touch that. Blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, that's a whole big conversation too, Ken.
Behind the scene, and the C-suite folks are telling us how big of a problem this is. We'll propose a great workshop that just opens the dialogue, and they freak out, nothing to do with it, right? So simultaneously, leadership and companies and cultures and organizations know this is a problem. Why EAPs exist in part, right? Employee programs were meant to help people with this. And yet they don't actually want to acknowledge it out loud still, right?
Yes. It's stunning. It's stunning. Okay. So let's do another little shift to stop saying that, or minimize saying that, or the five things.
Well, those were the five things.
Oh, well, okay. So they're kind of five in terms of what to say, what not to say.
So
is there any delineation in your mind
between what to say and what not to say?
Yeah. I mean, I can think of a few things that you absolutely should. If you're thinking that in your head, you just stop it. Stop it. Don't ever say that out loud.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, gosh. I think broadly, categorically, right? Anything that would oversimplify quitting is both shuts down your listener and or makes them feel like a greater failure. Like, you just need to hold it to two drinks. Some of the stuff that, like, duh, if it were that easy, right, they would have done it, which means you either don't understand me or I really suck, but nothing good comes out of oversimplified conversations about quitting. Most people with a substance use problem have regular dialogues in their own head.
Yeah.
About how this is not a good idea, promises they make themselves about how they're going to get under control or whatever. That whole oversimplification there is problematic. I think the second thing that I just cringe when I watch people go there is reflexive talk about inpatient treatment. That if we're going from not talking about it at all to I think you need 60 or 90 days, or my friend went to this treatment center or whatever, way to shut somebody down, make them not like, hey, by the way, great solution to this. We just need to chop off your hand. Oh, great. Let's have that conversation. That sounds fun.
Right.
So I think that is problematic. And then at the other end, I think.
So stay with that a little bit longer, because that is generally how people are approaching this, is you need to get fixed and rehab is your solution.
Yeah. So there's amazing rehab programs out there. And there's a ton of them, and some of those passionate individuals. The problem with rehab, in my experience, and the stats validate this, look at modern substance use treatment, is that is a relatively perfect environment to not be an addict in. Everything from they're making sure that stuff is not there to you're getting three squares a day. And if it's a bougie center, you might be getting massages and you get a ton of just high-end therapy. Like, in the grand scheme of things, that's an easy place to not use. You have to come back to the environment that you are the, and that's just, I mean, that's why there's a 40 to 80% relapse from 6 to 12 months when you look at inpatient, and all this money gets spent and there's a huge sense of failure that we relapse, right? So I think that's a big part of it, is it might be great for a hard stop, but if there is not seamless and community network, as we would call it, participation, somebody comes back, come back to the same spouse who mistreats you or whatever, you're going to relapse. You're going to go back into those behaviors. So I think that's a big piece of that, is oversimplifying what happens in that environment and transferring it back to the environment where somebody is an addict is a tall order. At the same end, I think just oversimplifying and waving your hand saying you need to go to AA or something like AA, my church has Celebrate Recovery or whatever it is. I think a lot of people who are struggling with substance use issues know what goes on in those groups well enough. Either they've been there and it's a much bigger problem for them than that, and or they're not ready to stop drinking or stop using or whatever. And so again, it just like this creating distance between you and the person who's struggling.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do when we wave our hands and say, well, you should do this, right? That gets paired with, you're asking about the five things not to say. Oversimplifying somebody's situation by saying, oh, well, my brother goes with, or my this or that, right? Making somebody else's journey their journey, and that's the reason for your oversimplified fix, again, shuts them down, right? I, as a cisgendered white male, say to my friend who is an African-American transgender woman, right? Like, that you just need to do this, and or my uncle or my life, and they're sitting there going, what does that have to do with the world that I live in?
Right. Yeah.
And so if we're not careful, those oversimplifications degrade connection, which turns off listening, turns off openness, all these things you should not say. That's going to be the biggest punchline, is if we shut people down, whether we mean to or not, and they don't feel connection and empathy and understanding, then they're done having any kind of meaningful conversation with us about themselves. So I think that's a big one. And then I think also the oversimplification of mental health treatment is one of the other ones that we see. Like, oh, you're drinking? Are you depressed? Right? That simple attachment of, oh, you must be anxious, that's why you're doing this. Or did you have trauma? Is that why? Were you abused as a kid? Most people that have mental health disorders don't also have substance use disorders, right? Most people who have substance use disorders, by definition, it's probably a mental health disorder, but concurrent or comorbid stuff.
Yeah.
But broadly affiliating those things is like, well, if we can just take care of the anxiety or depression, this goes away. It's not how it works. Gosh, that easy, therapists would be out of business, right? So relegating those struggles to simple mental health, like you just need to change the tires on your brain kind of thing. You just need to get a good therapist. If it were that easy, therapists would be healing substance use disorders left and right.
Right.
So those are probably the big ones, is all those things that look like oversimplification of the problem, right? You can sound compassionate, but if you show that you don't understand where this person's coming from, why would they listen to you any further, right? You're going to break connection, and connection is where we find healing. Connection is the opposite of addiction, all that kind of stuff. So that's one of the things I'd really be aware of, is just not that oversimplification. I'd also be aware that some people aren't willing to talk. Definitely don't want to talk in earshot of other people. And a lot of these times, grandma, grandpa, caring uncle, godparent, whatever, mm-hmm. to have this discussion while we're sitting by the fire and your spouse is 20 feet away and we're going to get my childhood trauma and why I drink. Good grief. Like, show some common sense, right? So just really being aware of when and where we talk about these things, mm-hmm. right? And then I think probably just broadly, I think people over-associate the holidays with hard times. They are hard for a lot of people. But anything that is, you'll get through this. Like, I believe in you. You've always been strong, right? Again, if addiction and substance use disorders were simply a matter of strength,
right,
there'd be so many people that weren't struggling. And honestly, a lot of people that aren't struggling worse because they're strong, badass people. And that's why their addiction is maybe held to a moderate level and not worse. Right. So again, just avoid the oversimplifications, avoid the over-identification with people. Mm-hmm. All those, tell that person, you're not a safe person for me.
So if you would, speak to the housewife that is just realizing that their spouse is drinking way too much. And there's a couple kids at home.
Yeah. So probably one of the best books I've read for a while there's that intervention show on TV. It was on when I was just enthralled. They can be some fairly magical moments. So I thought about doing some intervention work full time. There's a book out there called Love First, Interventions in General, mm-hmm. from the point of view of valuing the person. And that's why we're asking for change, right? Mm-hmm. The complaint is commensurate with the level of compliment. If you weren't so damn important to me, I wouldn't want you to change this thing, right? Mm-hmm. It would be, if your kids didn't like you so much, then I wouldn't be so sad that you're not present because mm-hmm. you're three drinks in. So as far as having the conversation and where do we go with that, that's a great place to start, is kind of mm-hmm. that love first approach. How do we help somebody understand their positive impact mm-hmm. before we help them understand their negative impact? I think that housewife, house husband, whatever that is discovering that mm-hmm. also needs to lean into their own education around addiction. And that's got to include professionals as much as it does friend support and all that. Friend support, we just start getting, what do they call it? Like home remedies and all that kind of stuff. You must have just take a teaspoon of this for that. So really getting some psychoeducation on addiction, how addiction mm-hmm. works. If there's kids involved, the worst thing you can do, I think, is chuck somebody's kids in the middle as leverage. So not that we don't talk about the kids, but if the kids don't need to know, or they don't need to know any more than they do, mm-hmm. shame goes up through the roof for a parent who feels like they're failing.
Yeah.
So do not use your kid's disappointment. Do not foster your kid's disappointment as a way of getting somebody to pay attention. Mm-hmm. That's trauma for your kids too.
Right.
Or back on you as the non-addict. I think we all need to look at, does addiction exist in my life? Sometimes the first place that we notice addiction is in other people because it's causing a problem for us. But that doesn't mean that we're not an addict ourselves. Mm-hmm. Think when somebody can step back and mm-hmm. go, okay, what's my version of this? Where do I overindulge? Maybe it's just I do 2 hours on the elliptical every day, but somewhere in there, I'm medicating away so I can function. Y'all mm-hmm. probably do it somehow. So what's my version of this? And that forces us to develop empathy with that person. What I would not do is some of the classic things that we see people do, which is dumping out alcohol or hiding the cigarettes mm-hmm. or all that kind of stuff. All that does is create animosity and incentivize people hiding things better.
Right. And they're good. Right?
Addicts have been hiding things for a long time. So not waging guerrilla warfare on that is mm-hmm. huge. I think, coming back to voices and courage and other things, in the end, there's so much stuff out there podcast-wise right now. People telling their stories. You don't even have to walk into an AA meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, to hear a lot of people's journeys. And mm-hmm. I kid you not, the more you listen to stuff like this, the more you're going to see the normalcy that of all parties involved. Mm-hmm. Spouse of the addict, like that's mm-hmm. one of the big things when I speak and I talk about being in a business owner who drinks too much. People mm-hmm. are like, my wife or my husband needs to talk to you. They run this huge carpet cleaning company, whatever, right? So I think that's a big piece, is we really want them, but that problem's been there for a while. Wouldn't want you to not intervene if there's an immediate danger. But that problem and you intervening on that problem can wait a month, 2, 3, until you get some more education under the belt, until you get a system. Don't run into battle unarmed there.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And that was part of the challenge on the front end of our experience. Was I still am not aware of there being a podcast out there that is dedicated to the loved ones. And there's more of us than there are of the people that are dealing with substance abuse disorder. And I have listened to hundreds, probably at this point, podcasts of people who are dealing with the disease, their stories, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or shopping or whatever it is. But I need more people like me that are talking about how did they go from crisis to thriving. And that thriving conversation is generally not happening out there.
No.
And that's what I aspired to.
Yeah, I think so much of the treatment modality of the last 20, 30 years is about getting people and families stabilized. It's not a discussion that, in fact, crisis, just like in business, crisis is actually an opportunity to take a gigantic leap forward in our functioning.
Yeah.
Somebody that addiction or substance use issues surfacing in a family are actually an invitation to deal with everything that's been holding this family back from greater intimacy, not because of the alcohol or whatever. It's mm-hmm. a symptom. So these are opportunistic moments. Mm-hmm. Stop pretending like the goal. And this is a problem with psychotherapy in general, right?
That yes.
over the last 40 years, 50 years, mm-hmm. psychotherapy has been treated as like, how do we get you back to stable? Instead of the fact that things we know, like in the UK, there was a study about men who went to therapy for the first time. Their income increased an average of 12%. In the year after they went to therapy. Mm-hmm. That's a huge opportunity. All the great athletes at this point have therapists and coaches and people that are inside their head working on the mental game. As a family, this is not just a chance to not completely screw up our lives.
Yes.
This is a chance to put the hood up and talk about everything that we've needed to talk about for a long time, right. All directions,
right.
Including the wounds that you've dealt to the addict.
Yes.
I'm sure you've hurt them too. You're not the reason that they're an addict, but they probably need some apologies from you. And it just may be about something 20 years ago that has nothing to do with it. It seems on the surface, right?
Yeah.
So that's one of the huge things here is by normalizing this, by allowing even the people who are in the supportive positions, the non-addict, non-substance use positions, to realize there's a whole bunch of us out here.
Mm-hmm.
who are trying to figure out where this fits into my life. How do I love on mm-hmm. somebody who it's right. clearly fitting into their life? And you're not reinventing the wheel. There's stories mm-hmm. here that you can mm-hmm. learn from. Support that can normalize and undemonize your spouse.
Yeah. Well, that one thing, two things I'm thinking about here. One, I would not have the amazing marriage that I have today if it wasn't for both of us leaning in to the crisis with our son.
Yeah.
And we routinely now talk about it as it was the greatest gift for us, up-leveling our level of connection and our clarity of how we love each other. And so I would not change what's happened at all, because I think for me, the story that I tell right now is that my son was the only one from a catalytic, like shake me to the core in order to crack me wide enough open to do that kind of work. So my story is generally, it's going to be our kids that hold the key and the potential for us to crack wide open and do the human connection, loving, deep loving in a healthy way, all the stuff. That's our journey too.
Yeah. Technologies that's been creeping into a lot of my speaking engagements publicly is, and I don't know that I was using it back when I spoke to your Vista troop way back, but it's the Japanese art of kintsugi is where when a vase would break or something in Japanese culture, they would actually glue it back together with molten gold. So if you go on the internet and look up kintsugi, K-I-N-T-S-U-G-I, you'll see these gorgeous pots that have these veins of gold running through the side. Well, it's such a beautiful analogy because gluing this together adds two profound effects on the vase. One, it makes it inherently more valuable because of the gold. Two, it actually increases the structural integrity of the vase. It's like putting rebar through the side of the vase. You're literally putting metal supports through this vase that was broken. So those vases actually become stronger and more valuable when glued back together properly. Right. And that's what I'm talking there. Like the stuff with your son shattered you in a way that nothing else could.
Right.
And then through the lean in, through intimacy, through working through this with your spouse, through all that stuff, like we actually end up stronger and closer if we do it right. And it's not this weird, shameful thing. And it's not a silver lining thing, by the way. Get rid of silver linings in your life, folks. Linings are a load of crap. There's parallel. You can have things happen to you that are simultaneously the worst thing and the best thing. Doesn't mean they cross cancel and one causes the other to make sense, right? But that could be one of the worst things that happened to you. And yet simultaneously, you could not know where you would be without that journey. And
so
all this stuff, when we look at it, that's what I'm into with all this is these are kintsugi moments. These are moments for us to take a hard look at what's broken. The process of even talking about it, caring for each other, connecting with people through things like voices encouraging, all this stuff. That's where we begin gluing it back together with gold.
Woo! Okay. I love you.
Thanks. I guess the clouds came over. It got kind of dark in my room. So sorry that I got a little shadowy, but I love being on this podcast. You have a great podcast.
Thank you so much. I mean, that's a great place for us to wrap it up on, kintsugi. I'm going to be looking that up and I think it's a brilliant metaphor. And so I'm going to do something I haven't done. And I would love again to have you come back and for us to spend the time talking about the gifts of a substance abuse disorder, which I think would be very provocative and poke a lot of polls and at generally the current culture around this. So are you game?
Oh, I'm absolutely game. You know me.
Okay. Super, super. So thank you so much, Ken. I mean, truly, deeply from the bottom of my heart.
Creating space really matters.
Absolutely. So okay. Thank you. Happy holidays.
We'll see you again soon.
Okay.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.